It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, a new study shows that a third of teenagers haven't read a book for pleasure in the past year. We'll find out what's cutting into their reading time. First, the Trump administration is preparing to roll back another Obama-era rule designed to address climate change. The Environmental Protection Agency is planning on introducing the proposal as early as tomorrow. It would loosen up some methane emission standards. Methane is a key greenhouse gas that's commonly leaked from oil and gas wells. Environmentalists worry the change will lead to far more methane getting out. Energy companies said the current rules requiring them to test for emissions were costly and burdensome. Steph Tai is an associate professor of law at UW-Madison. Steph, welcome back to the show.
Hi, thank you.
So what would change under these new EPA guidelines when it comes to methane emissions?
Well, what happened under the Obama administration was the Obama administration EPA passed a regulation that basically put what's called new source performance standards on these sort of oil and gas operations, basically to control any kind of leakages of methane. And I haven't seen the Trump administration's proposal yet because it hasn't been out. But what I've been reading about it is that it proposes to roll that back on the basis of the sort of increased costs and stuff like that.
Now, a lot of times when we talk about climate change, we talk about carbon dioxide, CO2, as the main issue. Talk about methane and how it fits into the story.
Yeah, so the reason why certain things are deemed greenhouse gases is because they absorb light in the spectrum in which normally light would be reflected back outside of the atmosphere. Carbon dioxide happens to absorb light within that spectrum, so it traps that heat within the Earth. Methane absorbs even more, so 25 times more sort of energy is absorbed within that spectrum that ordinarily would be released out of the atmosphere.
So even though there's less methane per unit, methane can be a bigger problem than CO2. Do I have that right?
Exactly.
So looking at this particular methane emission rule, there's another one coming from the Interior Department, I believe, going to be finalized and take effect next year. Do we see, again, knowing that there are some question marks about exactly how this would work, would this represent a significant increase ultimately in methane emissions in the United States?
It likely would. One thing that has happened is that for a while it was oil and gas operations that had the most methane coming out of it. Then for a while it was livestock. But then during the Obama administration, some of the calculations were sort of reassessed. And the Obama administration determined that, you know, one of those sort of leading causes, or actually the leading causes of methane emissions, was coming from oil and gas operations. And so that was the sort of impetus behind the Obama administration rule. Given if the rule is rescinded, then there would be less control over these sort of leakages from these oil and gas operations.
And the Trump administration with this and some other climate change-related issues have looked at the cost side a lot, talked about the burdens these kind of regulations place on the oil and gas industry, in this case, on the economy in general. How big an impact do you see that having?
In terms of paying attention to the cost, I think that's a large driver of them. One of the tricky things, though, is that the way that the Trump administration is assessing costs is different from the Obama administration. One of the things that the Obama administration was doing was looking at sort of what's called co-benefits. So the sort of side benefits that would result from reducing emissions. And they were using that in their cost-benefit analysis to say that, you know, the sort of benefits outweigh the costs in putting in place these regulations. The Trump administration has proposed to change that. We'll see what happened. There's been a number of sort of environmental groups and other advocacy groups that have talked about challenging this kind of new approach towards cost-benefit regulations, but our cost-benefit analysis. But it is likely that this sort of change in focus in terms of cost-benefit analysis is driving some of the sort of regulatory rescission.
Talking to Steph Tai, Associate Professor of Law at UW-Madison, about new Trump administration guidelines on the way that would allow, would cut back some of the restrictions on methane emissions, putting that in the context of wider efforts on climate change. This would be a next step, Steph. People point toward a couple other big changes under the Trump administration, dialing back some Obama-era auto emission standards and dialing back Obama-era coal power plant regulations. Can you talk about what has changed so far under the Trump administration?
Yeah, so the Trump administration has conducted a number of sort of changes. One of them is, as you mentioned, the sort of Clean Power Plan, which they're proposing to sort of rescind. There's also some of the sort of clean fuel kind of automobile efficiency kind of standards. They're also proposing, or at least what I've read, they're proposing to reconsider the waiver that has been granted to California to have a more stringent kind of standard. One of the things that the Clean Air Act allows is it allows for California and any other state that feels like it wants to follow California to adopt sort of more stringent standards set by California. The Obama administration allowed for California to adopt more stringent standards. And what I've been reading is that the Trump administration is sort of reconsidering the earlier grant of that waiver.
Can states like California chart their own course to any great extent, given these changes coming from the federal government? I know the governor of California is part of a nationwide effort involving state leaders and local governments and businesses trying to change some climate change emissions even without the federal government.
Yeah, I mean, California, as you know, because it's such a large economy, does have a very persuasive role overall to industry. So they can do some stuff. One of the tricky parts is going to be what I referred to just now, which is the extent to which any kind of federal regulation don't want to say Trump's because I don't mean it as a pun, kind of federal regulation surpasses the state regulations. And to the extent that there's a sort of exact overlap in the ideas to evaluate this under federal supremacy, then the sort of federal laws would apply. Now, there's going to be legal fights about that. And those legal fights have occurred under the Bush administration. They've occurred in the reverse under the Obama administration. So all of this is going to play out in courts, I think.
Now, everything we're talking about pretty much was executive action here. The Obama administration put in these guidelines on methane, on auto emissions, on power plants. The Trump administration is reversing them. This is all done without Congress. The White House, the presidency, has a lot of sway over how we control these emissions.
Yes, absolutely. And that is the structure of the Clean Air Act, because the Clean Air Act and many of our sort of major statutes don't set forth the details whereby an agency implements things, because, you know, it's not like Congress is full of scientists or anything like that. And so it leaves a lot of the details to be set by agencies who are under the control of the executive. And so that's why we have this system where there's a lot of authority within the executive branch to sort of shape policies where the details are left forward for agencies to configure.
That ends up, as we see right now in what we're talking about, that can lead to a lot of back and forth and big changes from one administration and one party to the next, can it?
It can. One thing that can act as a little bit of a counterweight is what's known as the Administrative Procedure Act. That's an act that's also passed by Congress that sets forth standards that agencies must always follow, whatever administration, to either pass regulations or rescind regulations. It's all treated the same under the APA. And that provides a little bit of a counterweight against sort of huge swings back and forth, because it requires agencies to at least act in a non-arbitrary and capricious kind of way. And so to that extent, there's a little bit of constraining force within this statute.
And can someone try to thwart that with some kind of legal challenge? If so, who? Who would have standing to, say, take these methane regulations and take the EPA to court?
Well, states have been sort of raising these kinds of challenges. Groups that feel like they are going to be affected in some kind of particularized manner sufficient to establish constitutional standing can raise these challenges. There are a number of outside groups that are likely to raise these challenges. And these challenges have been raised to some prior actions of this administration. So I'm expecting we'll see some court challenges here too.
And briefly, as we wrap up, could Congress conceivably step in and say, we want to narrow down a little bit more what we mean by the Clean Air Act and limit the power of the presidency and limit that flexibility?
Absolutely. Congress could always amend the Clean Air Act to either constrain the president from shifting the EPA towards one direction or another, or it could set forth specific procedures for dealing with greenhouse gases. These are all within the realm of Congress.
Steph, thanks a lot for joining us again.
Thank you.
Steph Tai is an associate professor of law at UW-Madison. We talked about the Trump administration's plan to weaken methane air pollution rules. Right now, new research shows that a growing number of teens aren't reading books. In fact, a third of them haven't read a book or an e-book for fun in the past year. And they're not much in the newspapers either. Only 2% of sophomores read them daily compared to 33% in the early 1990s. So what are they doing? Lots of web surfing and gadget time. In 2016, the average high school senior spent 6 hours a day online. That's twice as much as in the previous decade. Gene Twenge is a psychology professor at San Diego State University and the author of iGen, Why Today's Super Connected Kids Are Growing Up Less Rebellious, More Tolerant, Less Happy, and Completely Unprepared for Adulthood. She's also the lead author of the reading study. Gene, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
Well, spell out the basics of the findings. How much less are kids reading nowadays?
A lot less. So if you look at 12th graders, 17 and 18-year-olds, if you ask them if they read a book, a magazine, or a newspaper, how often they do that, back in the late 1970s, about 60% said they read every day. And now it's about 16%.
It's a big drop. And as we talked to you about your book a while back, what they're doing instead is digital stuff, right?
That's what it looks like. So, you know, a little bit of that shift is that they might be reading short newspaper articles or short magazine articles online, but it probably doesn't account for the drop in books. If you're reading a book, you know you're reading a book, whether it's, you know, in print or on an iPad. So what's really increased is the amount of time teens spend online and on social media and playing games and watching videos online. That seems to be what has replaced reading long-form text like books and magazine articles.
Is this necessarily a bad thing? Is this a negative thing that kids aren't reading books or e-books like they used to?
Well, I think so, mostly because they're just not getting that experience reading long-form text. So they might be well-informed and be able to look up information quickly, and that's great, and that's one of the benefits of the Internet age. But they're not getting the practice with sitting and reading one thing for more than, you know, 20 minutes at a time. When you're online, you're switching tasks so quickly. And then they end up in college and get handed an 800-page textbook. And they're going to need to sit down and read that for a longer period of time and concentrate and learn how to think critically and learn how to understand complex issues. And they just don't have as much experience doing that when they enter college.
Now, your survey was looking at reading, I guess, kind of on their own time, as I understand it. Presumably, kids are still being handed books to read in junior high and high school. Is that enough?
So, yes, our survey does ask about reading for pleasure. It's specifically mentioned to that they want to know about reading outside of what's assigned for school. I don't know of any systematic data on what's being assigned for school, but I have heard anecdotally from teachers that more and more students complain about being assigned books and longer readings, and that a lot of classrooms have kind of responded to that and moved toward more videos and shorter text. So they're not even getting as much long-form text reading in school.
Now, this follows up on a lot of research you did for your book, iGen. You're seeing a real generational change. Something very fundamental, you say, is changing about this younger generation. How does this change in reading fit into that?
Well, what's really shifted is that the way teens spend their leisure time has fundamentally changed. So if you think about even 10 or 15 years ago, how teens spent their time, most of it was hanging out with their friends. And when they weren't doing that, they might be reading or, you know, tinkering around the house. And now the vast majority of teens' leisure time is spent with screens on phones and tablets or in front of gaming consoles. It's the screen activities, which, you know, used for a limited amount of time are not necessarily bad, but they now take up so much time that they're crowding out the amount of time teens used to spend hanging out with each other face-to-face, reading, and sleeping. And those are three things that we know are linked to good mental health and happiness. Screen time, if anything, is linked to less happiness. So that's a the difficulty, the challenge of this internet era is we have teens spending their leisure time in a way that's not conducive to their mental health.
Talking to Gene Twenge, psychology professor at San Diego State University, author of the book iGen, about some new research she's done on reading among teens. It's down, way down over the last few decades. So, Gene, what, I don't know if anything, could we do to turn the tide here?
Well, you know, I think that in some ways this is a good news story, at least in terms of mental health and happiness, because so many things that are behind how happy we are or mental health are things that we can't change, like genetic predisposition or trauma or poverty. But we can choose how we spend our leisure time, and we can help our kids and teens make good choices about how they spend their leisure time. And if they want to spend an hour or so on social media or watch videos, that's fine, an hour or so a day. But 2 hours a day and beyond is where these negative effects seem to show up. So if we can limit that screen time to 2 hours a day or less, that leaves more time for reading, seeing friends, and getting enough sleep.
Are we seeing mental health impacts here among younger people? Are we seeing them be less happy as the screen time goes up?
That's exactly what we're seeing. So right around 2012, which is when smartphones became common, teen happiness began to fall. Their life satisfaction also began to fall. Even more concerning, right around that time, teen depression shot up, anxiety shot up, self-harm behaviors like cutting started to increase, and the teen suicide rate went up. So across the board, there's this very systematic pattern of right around 2011 and 2012, something clearly went wrong in the lives of teens. And my best guess is that's because that was the tipping point when the majority had smartphones. They were spending a lot more time on social media and online and less time with each other in person. Also, when sleep deprivation started to go up. The trend for reading has been going on for a while, so that's probably not as involved in the trends in mental health.
I want to talk, I want to get your take on what maybe the healthcare fields can do about this. I know there's a project for infants and toddlers where, and there's a big Wisconsin component here, where doctors, pediatricians are putting books in their hands and taking it from there as part of their well-child visits. Do we need something like this for, I don't know, teens and tweens where healthcare providers are talking about screen time?
I think so, because it's true. A lot of those interventions tend to be focused on younger kids, and that's good, and we need those interventions at that age group, but in my view, we also need them for teens, because that's when screen time really goes through the roof. You know, little kids aren't on social media, and they're usually not texting their friends. They're not quite as likely to spend hours and hours and hours on computer games. The teens are, and there's so many teens who are spending enormous amounts of time on screens and thus probably not enough time on these other beneficial activities. So I think that's a conversation that a lot of healthcare providers need to have with parents and teens.
I've talked to child-raising experts who say the best way to teach a lesson to a kid is for a parent to model that lesson. We definitely see a lot of parents, people in older generations, with that phone in their hands. Could we, the older generations, be doing better to model reading and other healthy activities for kids?
Absolutely. And I think that's something that we all need to think about. So this idea of limiting screen time, that's not just for teens, that's for adults too. Some of the things around sleep that are so important, like no phones in the bedroom, don't be looking at your phone right before you go to bed. Adults need to do that, too, for their own health as well as to be good role models for their children. And then in terms of reading, that's often the thing that comes up as well, that when parents are reading and have books in the home, then that's an obvious encouragement for kids to read as well.
What is your best case outcome? Looking at the data, looking at your latest research, what are you hoping for this generation?
Well, I think there's some really good signs out there. So, you know, most of the book relies on these big surveys, but I also did some in-depth interviews with teens and young adults, and I was pleasantly surprised at how aware they are of this world. I thought perhaps that their attitude would be, hey, this is just the way things are now. Anybody who thinks differently is just old. But that was not their viewpoint. They can see many of the downsides of the way we live now, spending so much time on phones. They understand at a fundamental level that's not a good way to live. It's just it feels mandatory to them. It's often addictive, and they find it really tough to give up those hours and hours and hours on their phone, which is not shocking because a lot of older people do too. So that's why I think parents have to step in and just help their teens set limits. And, of course, there's some kids are going to have some resistance to that. Others are surprisingly receptive to the idea of, hey, there's going to be times we're not going to have the phone around, and we can't have that in the bedroom and not at the dinner table and not when I'm hanging out with my friends.
We'll leave it there. Jean, thanks a lot for joining us again.
Absolutely.
Jean Twenge is a psychology professor at San Diego State University. She's the author of iGen, Why Today's Super Connected Kids Are Growing Up Less Rebellious, More Tolerant, Less Happy, and Completely Unprepared for Adulthood. We talked with her about her latest research showing that a third of teens haven't read a book for fun in the past year. First, the Wisconsin Board for People with Developmental Disabilities has released its budget policy goals for the 2019 through 2021 fiscal period. The group, which advocates for Wisconsinites with disabilities and their families, outlined seven main policy areas that they say changing could help a number of people throughout the state. Policies range from transportation access to employment opportunities to support for caregivers. Our next guest is here to talk about those policies and what reforms they'd like to see in the state over the next few years. Beth Swedeen is Executive Director of the Wisconsin Board for People with Developmental Disabilities. Beth, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
So the budget is still a little ways off. Why are you getting this out there now to try to get these ideas on the table?
Yeah, great question. I think most people aren't thinking about that at all right now because the governor, whoever the governor will be, won't announce a budget until probably January or February. But a lot of the state agencies right now are putting together their ideas. So the Department of Public Instruction, Department of Health Services, they're all having to get budgets into the governor by September 15th. So we wanted to get some ideas out for early consideration and also so that people across the state know that they're being heard and that their ideas are something that they can take to their elected officials earlier than, you know, during the winter.
And before we get to the specific suggestions, do you have, are you reaching out to people with disabilities around the state? Are they kind of informing you as to what their priorities and
exactly,
needs are?
Exactly. We are a council of people. We are the state's designated developmental disabilities council made up of people with developmental disabilities and their family members. And our charge really is to listen to all corners of the state, consider what the pressing issues are, and then think about policy solutions and public programs that can be improved to make people with disabilities have the lives that anyone would want and, you know, use services in a way that keeps them in their communities, keeps them participating in daily life, working, playing, you know, recreating, doing all the things that anyone else would want to do in Wisconsin. So, yes, we are listening to those folks. We've been out to all parts of the state, and the issues that we talk about are things that really are on the minds of so many people with disabilities and their families right now.
And one of the items on your list involves something we've talked about a fair amount on the show in the past, caregivers, and that's professional paid caregivers and people who aren't getting paid for it, family members, things like that. Let's start with the paid side of things. It
sure.
Sounds like we have a shortage of available professional caregivers.
Well, Wisconsin has a shortage, but the nation has a shortage as well. And a lot of it is just demographics. We have an aging population. You know, people are getting older. They're living in healthy lives into their 80s and 90s. And then we have increasing numbers of people with disabilities living longer lives as well. And then we have a smaller amount of younger people in the workforce. And so as the baby boomers reach retirement, you know, and in even older people, then we're seeing that there's fewer and fewer people even available to do care. And then at the same time, the wages haven't kept up with what the demands of the job are. So we can see people going to Target or going to Home Depot and getting a job and getting a couple dollars an hour more than a paid caregiver who really maybe wants to stay in the business of helping other people, but it's just something that they can't afford to do. So a lot of the solutions we're looking at are ways to really incentivize the job, to recognize that it's really important work, that it's valuable, that people who do it care, and that they deserve the wages and benefits that anybody who's doing a high-level job would deserve. deserve.
I want to talk about the impact here. There was a survey a while back for people with disabilities talking about, you know, how has your life been impacted when there is that gap in caregiving? Can you right. talk about the sort of effect that can have?
Sure. Our organization is part of the Survival Coalition, and that's 30 different disability orgs across the state. And we did do a survey a year and a half ago or so, and over 500 people responded. And virtually all of them, like 95%, said they had trouble finding caregivers. More than 45% said that they'd missed seven or more shifts in the last month. And when you start missing that many shifts, what you see is people who are forced to stay in a chair overnight, you know, with no ability to get out of the chair, people getting bed sores, people who miss medications, who don't have access to food or water because they can't move themselves. And all of a sudden, something that becomes an annoyance is all of a sudden a very critical health concern or acute health concern. So we actually know people who say, hey, I'm a young person, but because I can't get enough caregivers, the recommendation is I should live in a nursing home. Well, that's just not appropriate. And it's not anything that anyone wants to do. So the caregiver shortage is to the point where it is at a crisis.
You mentioned hoping the state can help incentivize people to get into caregiving. I guess translate that a little bit into budget terms. What
sure.
kind of things specifically could the state do?
Well, one of the things we're looking at is looking at the number of caregivers who are in the profession already who are on BadgerCare or other Medicaid programs because they're low-wage workers. And so could we lift the Medicaid wage requirement, or, you know, to a higher level, maybe 300% of poverty instead of 100 or 200, and make them eligible for Medicaid, because that is a health insurance plan. And a lot of caregivers do not have health insurance right now, or they're already on Medicaid. And what we hear a lot of provider networks saying to us is, hey, I've got some really fantastic workers, and they're only working like 15 or 20 hours a week because they need to keep their Medicaid. So if we could raise the amount that they could keep, then they can keep the insurance that's so important to them. And we get that many more hours of really great care in the community.
A lot of caregiving is provided by maybe friends or loved ones. Mm-hmm. Are there things the state could do to help them out?
I think just recognizing family caregivers, you know, businesses can be involved in that, understanding the need for flexibility. So there are lots of things that just, I think, just when you recognize caregiving, when you say we're going to pay attention to it, looking at leave policies, that sort of thing, those kinds of things can help too. And then we're also looking at, back to the paid caregiver thing, you know, there are parts of the state where maybe just across the border, the state allows a higher wage. So those are the things we need to look at, too, is, you know, are we losing workers to Minnesota or to Illinois? And can we make sure that the wages are equitable in those kind of border areas?
We're talking to Beth Swedeen with the Wisconsin Board for People with Developmental Disabilities, looking at some priorities for the state budget in particular, they say could make a big difference for people with disabilities here in the state. Beth, another priority area, access to transportation for people with disabilities.
Right.
And I imagine this is not a one-size-fits-all. It might be different in a city with a big public transit system versus a rural area. What kind of things are you looking at?
Yes, I just came from a statewide meeting, and the number one issue at this meeting across aging groups and disability groups was that lack of access to transportation when you need it and on time and going where you need to go. And you're right, it's one of those issues that is so dependent on where you live in the state. And there are many, many transportation alternatives that stop at a city line or stop at a county border. And as you know, many people work just across a county line, or they work in the next city over. And so they're literally not able to get to work. And many, many people with disabilities don't have cars, they don't drive. And so the idea that we need to figure out some really creative solutions here around blending or more like braiding public funding sources and thinking about some creativity so that people can get where they need to go is so important. And it really is a huge factor in allowing people with disabilities to be part of the workforce.
Right. I wanted to ask about that. How big a deal breaker is this for someone maybe with a disability who wants to live independently and get to a job, hold down a job?
Right.
This is something that is a wall.
Everything is tied to transportation. So, you know, getting to your doctor's appointments on time so that you can maintain your health, getting your prescriptions when you need them, going to the grocery store. But a lot of people say this is the deal breaker for me on either finding a job or keeping a job.
And you mentioned working with senior groups. Is this something where the state could answer maybe a couple of concerns at the same time with people with disabilities and with seniors who want to live independently still?
Right, right. And actually, it's something that is an issue for low-wage workers as well. I mean, a lot of people cannot afford to maintain a car, or they have a car, and if it's not reliable, it impacts their ability to be reliable on their jobs. So we think that there's a lot of different advocacy groups and different populations in the state that when we come up with creative transportation solutions, they're all going to benefit.
We're talking to Beth Sodine right now, Executive Director of the Wisconsin Board for People with Developmental Disabilities. She's with us to talk about policy changes her organization would like to see change to help people with disabilities in the state. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are we talking about your life? What kind of changes would you like to see if you're a person with disabilities yourself, if a family member is? What do you think are these issues of transportation, finding caregiving important to you? Or are there other issues that you think, hey, this little change by the state or maybe big change could make a big difference in our lives? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. 1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we continue our conversation about living with disabilities in Wisconsin and state policies in particular that affect people with disabilities. Beth Sodine is with us, Executive Director of the Wisconsin Board for People with Developmental Disabilities. Her organization just released a list of 7 policy changes they'd like to see tackled by the state, especially in next year's budget. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you have a disability, what would you like to see change in Wisconsin, maybe at the state level, to make things work a little better? If you're a parent or caregiver, what do you think? How would this? What do you need to see to change your life, make things a little easier? What issues do you face? What roadblocks do you run into? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll go to Mary Ann on the phone now in Hurdle. Mary Ann, hi.
Hi. I have a comment. My husband's recent stroke victim. And so, as a result, he is unable to get into a car, stand and pivot and get into a car. So he is restricted to a wheelchair, and this is not likely to change. Now, we have a house, so it's not as if we're able to use, like, Medicaid or Badger Care or a lot of the organizations that help with transportation. So if he goes to the doctors, it's $150 to transport him there and get him back home. And Burnett County, Wisconsin, the ADRC, has absolutely no facility to help people in our situation.
Marianne, thanks a lot for the call. Are there things out there, Beth, that you think could help in Marianne and her husband's county or elsewhere in the state?
Well, I'm glad Marianne mentioned the Burnett County Aging and Disability Resource Center, the ADRC, because that was my first thought. And the fact that maybe they don't have the resources means that I would personally suggest she call the Department of Health Services and ask for the entity that oversees the ADRCs, because I would think that they would be able to help with some of that. The other thing that comes to mind is every region of the state has an independent living center, or ILC, independent living center. So I can't remember which one is in that northwestern part of the state, but you can, if you Googled independent living centers, they are, a lot of them have equipment on loan, and they also have different resources to help people with that kind of issue. A third resource, because she mentioned a house, is there's a place, or there's an organization in Madison that serves statewide called Movin' Out, and they oftentimes can help with home modifications and provide either low interest, no interest loans, or even funding for home modifications. So those are kind of three of the ideas that I have right off the bat.
Thanks for the call, and good luck to you. We'll go now to Mark in Oneida County. Mark, hi.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah, what do you want to tell us about, Mark?
Well, I'm a 60-year-old person, just had a heart attack, which affected my eyes, and I'm having problems getting transportation to the doctors, getting transportation to get food, and just get out of the house.
Right. And so, Mark, do you know about the Aging and Disability Resource Center?
I've been to ADRC in Rhinelander, yes.
Okay. And have they been able to help at all with any ideas?
Well, they try, but they give me things, and I missed my last two doctor's appointments because the people they sent me to get a ride, I stood at the end of my driveway for an hour, and they never showed, they never called. And I'm really frustrated.
Is that the non-emergency medical transportation? Is that what?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay. Again, I would, I hate to sound like a cranky person, but, contacting them, that provider, but also contacting the Department of Health Services to complain about the quality. We hear this, unfortunately, over and over again about non-emergency medical transport, and they really need to be accountable. And there are lots of ways that they could, like, call you in advance, you know, to let you know if they're late or if they need directions. And we hear this so many times. And again, it's to the point I made earlier, Rob, of people missing critical medical care because their ride didn't show up on time. And if the ride shows up an hour late, sorry, the doctor has seen two more patients and you're out of luck.
Mark, thanks for the call and good luck to you. That non-emergency medical transportation, is that something you are hoping to see more resources put into?
We actually have a request in our budget papers around kind of a pay for performance. In other words, we think that whoever the state contracts with should really be held accountable for the rides that they give. Are they on time? Are they communicating with the client? What's the percentage rate? And then what's the complaint process? And that they should be paid accordingly. You should not be paying taxpayer dollars for something that doesn't meet your needs and doesn't get you where you need to go.
Talking to Beth Swedin from the Wisconsin Board for People with Developmental Disabilities, looking at priorities for people with disabilities in upcoming state budgets. Before I go back to our callers, Beth, I want to get into another issue area in this in your policy statement here, and that's education for people with disabilities. What are you looking at?
Right. So we know that students with disabilities, including those with even the most significant disabilities, can make great headway in public education with the right supports in place. Unfortunately, funding for special education in the state of Wisconsin has been held steady or stagnant for the last decade. And as you probably know, inflation, cost of everything has gone up. A lot of technologies that would help students, you know, there's a price tag on those, and they haven't kept pace with what the students need. And so we are recommending a significant increase in special education funding to kind of meet that gap and really bring schools the resources they need so that they can meet students' needs and make sure that they're successful and that they're prepared for adulthood.
Yeah. Can you talk about the difference that can make after graduation?
Oh, absolutely. Because students with significant disabilities actually have access in Wisconsin and across the country to 3 extra years of education between 18 and 21. And in school districts that have the funds, they're oftentimes getting them into real jobs and providing transportation out to job sites. They're teaching them skills to live in their own apartments. But those things cost money and they're based in the community. And oftentimes those kinds of programs, when cuts have to be made, are the first to go because quality is the first thing to go. And so getting those funds in place, we know has a direct line to better outcomes for students with disabilities. And we're always advocating that those resources need to be available because they're a great investment now into the future of people who can really contribute and make a difference.
Let's bring on another caller now. Mark is with us in Wauwatosa. Mark, hi.
Hi.
Hi, what'd you want to bring up, Mark?
Well, the subject of caregiver contracts, my wife was a caregiver for her mother for 5 years with Alzheimer's. Her mother finally passed away, this year. We took her on right away as soon as her husband died, she needed care. And it took us about a year to learn about caregiver contracts. And then it took a little while to convince my brother-in-law to come on. Hey, the mother-in-law had the money. but she had, you know, too much money that she didn't qualify for government care. You know, she had a house that was paid for and money in the bank, and she had income coming in, too, from Social Security and so on, and pension money, too. So, you know, my wife structured it, got a lawyer to sign off and notary public and all this, and the brother-in-law, who was the power of attorney, you know, he finally agreed to it after a while, and you know, she got to pay. And so, you know, that helped us make ends meet for those years. But a little public awareness campaign that you can do this would be useful.
Mark, thanks a lot for the call. Beth, I'm not familiar with this, but is this something that I should be more familiar with, and we should know more about this?
I'm not aware either of caregiver contracts and what exact context he's talking about.
But does the state do enough to, I guess, give guidance to those family caregivers? Is there more the state could do apart from these contracts?
I think that there's probably things that a lot of us could do to help support family caregivers. I guess I'm not sure about the sort of internal nature where he got the information about contracting. But yeah, I think that there's always guidance and best practice kinds of ideas around that. And oftentimes, you know, just doing a search. I know our national organization and our board have some resources on our website.
Thanks for that call, Mark. One area that I was really quite unfamiliar with, I got to say, Beth, is improved self-direction as a policy goal. This has to do with guardianship and related issues. Can you talk a little bit about what that means?
Sure. So a lot of people with disabilities and older adults, you know, who experience dementia or other kinds of disabilities, their family members are worried about their safety, and so they seek guardianship. And what we're finding in the disability world is a lot of young people, given the right training, preparation, that sort of thing, actually don't need a guardian. They might need a supported decision, you know, some help in support and making decisions. We were actually part of a movement to get a law in place in April that recognizes supported decision making so people don't have to go to guardianship. And we really believe that if you are a guardian, you probably need some training and to be better equipped to understand how you can help fully support a person to make as many decisions as possible for themselves.
And that there would be a time period, a renewal of guardianship in some cases?
Correct. I mean, were any of us at the age of 18 fully capable of making the wisest decisions of all? And so we're thinking, you know, your brain's still developing at 18. That's no different if you have a disability. Let's think again when you're maybe 26 or 27. You know, have you learned enough that maybe this isn't as much of a need now?
Beth, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
Beth Swedeen is Executive Director of the Wisconsin Board for People with Developmental Disabilities. She joined us today to talk about policies the organization would like to see changed or improved, looking especially ahead at next year's state budget, in order to help Wisconsinites with disabilities, their families, and their caregivers. Still time to share your thoughts, maybe your experiences. You can do that over on the Ideas Network Facebook page, or you can always email us and let us know what's going on. Ideas@WPR.org. Are these issues that affect your life or the lives of your family? Tomorrow is your last chance to hang out with Bucky Badger, but you might be able to bring him home. Earlier this year, 85 Bucky Badger statues were unveiled at sites around the Madison area. They're each decorated by different artists, with each with their own theme. Events related to the Bucky on Parade statues have raised money for local charities. I've seen a fancy suit Bucky, a hockey-playing Bucky. There's, I understand, a biotech Bucky, and of course a marching band and a football one as well. Tomorrow is their last day out on display. They're coming down before winter hits. So for people who want their Bucky-themed selfies, this is your last chance. Some of the statues will go back to their artists or sponsors. They may turn up on display somewhere, and you could end up with one of them. At an event later this month, 30 of these unique Bucky Badgers will be auctioned and or raffled off at a big event. So what would you do with your own Bucky? Obviously, if you have a business, you could put it on display. Good conversation starter at dinner parties at your home. If you're a political candidate, there's a lot of you out there. Hey, what better than appearing at that rally with Bucky? And I'm encouraging Central Time producers to get out there and raffle one and just put it right in the middle of the office. I think it'd be very inspiring. So get on that, guys. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.